Welcome to the Command Line Podcast for August 26th, 2009. I'm your host, Command Line, the self-proclaimed hacker, curmudgeon, and hacktivist, and this is my show about the practice and profession of programming, drawing from over a decade of professional experience and a lifetime spent hacking, the intersection of society and politics with technology, and anything else clever, elegant, or funny that catches my mind as a diehard technology geek. This episode is a feature cast. In it, I have a monologue on the topic of embracing fair use and a new hacker word of the week. First, though, I wanted to give a quick review of a film that I think is long overdue. I actually sat down to watch this Sunday after the last news program when I was talking about Nina Paley releasing the animation source files for her feature-length animated film, Sita Sings the Blues. For all the talk around the efforts that Nina has gone to clear the performances by Annette Hanshaw that are really pivotal to this film, and then to turn around and not only release the finished work itself as open content, but as I said, to release the sources to it so people can more easily remix it and pay it forward. For all of that talk, it just occurred to me I had never actually taken the time to speak about the character of the work itself. At its heart, this is a remix as well. It's a remix of the story that's at the heart of the Indian classic, the Ramayana. And this is the romance between Sita and Rama. And Paley has a very unique way of retelling this that makes it very, very accessible. She actually uses, I think, about four distinct animation styles and kind of narrative styles in the process of telling this and weaves them through in a way that at first takes a little bit of adjustment, but then after a while you become very accustomed to it, and it has sort of a quirky but highly emotional, somewhat humorous, really, really great feel to it. There are some narrators that are built in that come in as necessary to expand a little bit on the actual underlying text, and she does that in a way that doesn't come across as academic or dry at all. She does it very conversationally, and visually what she does for that, the conceit that she uses, I find pretty cool. She uses these kind of traditional shadow puppets that she animates with very clearly very modern voices discussing their recollections of this myth that was clearly a part of their lives growing up in that culture. One of the things that she does that I think that makes this film really stand out is she also ties it in very closely with her own personal experience. That's one of the narrative threads, one of the animation styles. When it switches, it's to denote that change to that other thread that she's woven into this. And it just really has a nice emotional resonance as a consequence as we see the things that are unfolding between Rama and Sita and the other characters in this epic poem, and then how that actually reflects into the story of Nina's life. Very interesting stuff. And she has just a very deft touch at the end that I think is especially kind of bittersweet. There's really no excuse for you not to actually watch this film if you haven't already. As I said, it's freely available. I do encourage you to donate to help Nina with the cost to distribute this, to offset her hosting. It's available in a variety of places, a variety of ways. I actually got a BitTorrent of the highest quality video, and it's definitely the quality of the animation, the quality of the production, the sound engineering, everything really stands up to the home theater experience. So this is not a short film, as I mistakenly called it in the last news piece when I was talking about it. It's not really even, I would say, comparable to a lot of film festival films I've seen. Really, it is a feature-length film that has, as I said, hopefully I've been able to kind of capture, without, again, spoiling it, some of the narrative richness of this, the visual and audio complexity that make this such an engaging work. For the geek parents out there, last thing I'll say about this, I wouldn't really recommend sharing this with the kids. There's nothing in here that's graphic or really explicit, although it definitely does deal with adult themes. I just don't think it's going to be the sort of thing that's going to be of interest to the younger ones. Maybe perhaps if you have, again, older teenage kids that are starting to have experiences of love and loss and life lessons, this may be a good film to share with them because, as I said, it is not graphic or explicit, but it does, in a very mature and adult way, deal with these topics. So your mileage may vary. If you're concerned at all and you do want to screen it for your family, just go ahead and give it a watch through yourself. I think it would stand up to repeated viewings, so no risk there. The hacker word of the week comes from the Jargon File, maintained by Eric Raymond at catb.org. Enhancement. Noun. Common market droid speak for a bug fix. This abusive language is a popular and time-tested way to turn incompetence into increased revenue. A hacker being ironic will instead call the fix a feature, or perhaps save some effort by declaring the bug itself to be a feature. When I don't have enough bile for a rant, and can't muster the necessary peace and serenity for an inner chapter, all that's left is for me to express my evil genius side and do a monologue. I received an email some time ago from listener Alex Bischoff. You may recognize Alex's name if you've been listening for some time. He's the one who usually writes in with very clear and well-researched corrections on my pronunciations. They're often very appreciated. Actually, they're always very appreciated, and I in humor, I jest about giving him some static about that, but absolutely, I do appreciate everybody who sends in information to help me improve the show. And I have to apologize for not getting to this topic a little bit sooner. It's just been buried in the queue, and it's only just now come up in my research and my writing. Anyway, at that time, Alex wrote, "We always hear about bad companies that don't understand how fair use works, but it'd be interesting to hear about companies that embrace fair use as well. For instance, George Lucas appears to welcome the proliferation of many Star Wars parodies across the web. It's a good question. I used to actually try to find such examples to share when I spoke, in particular at science fiction conventions or other fan gatherings. Lucas was one example, as Alex mentions. CBS Paramount was another. They allowed Star Trek New Voyages to utilize their property and even supported it in its transition to kind of realizing Gene Roddenberry's long-term vision for reinvigorating that franchise, and they relabeled their project Phase 2, which was actually the name that Roddenberry had planned to use for one of the various successors to the original series. Both of these originally merely said that fan use was fine, as long as those uses didn't profit. It's tempting to try to find other such examples. I actually stopped looking a while ago, to be honest. These examples really are much harder to find than you think. And when I really sat down to actually think about the question, I think it's the wrong question to pose. Companies shouldn't embrace fair use. They should use public licenses. Fair use is part of limits and exceptions under copyright. It is most important for new and current works. The public domain is also a critical limit and exception on copyright, and it should complement fair use and provide a shared commons on which creators can draw to remix and reuse for older works. This is why the extension of terms in copyright is such a problem, and many folks interested in more balanced and creator and consumer-friendly copyright law, like myself, agonize over the various extensions that have happened both here in the U.S. and in many other places besides. It's not the same as a license, though. Neither of these forms of limits and exceptions are. You take a risk when you do something assuming fair use. It won't be tested unless a rights holder actually makes a claim. And then it's up to a judge to decide the merits of a fair use defense in the light of that complaint. Based on recent news stories, judges are interpreting fair use increasingly narrowly. The outcome may also depend largely on where you are tried, too. That's where precedent and lobbying, actually, I think the latter, when you get out into some of the Western jurisdictions where Hollywood holds some sway, actually have as much of an impact as any kind of scholarly legal interpretation or discussion. To be fair, educational commentary or a review is rarely going to risk a claim, but we definitely have seen those come to pass where people who looked at something and said traditionally most judges would have decided that this was a fair use. We've seen rights holders make claims in those cases, so you really can't even rely on history to be a good predictor of what folks will leave alone. Fan works are landmines. The cases I'm aware of are pretty mixed, and the fair use guidelines and ruling on these are far from clear. Arguably, the more devoted the fan work, the closer it gets to the heart of the original work. This is most likely to deflate any fair use defense, since that is one of the four considerations that are encapsulated into the fair use laws. There's this four-point guideline. I'll try to find some resources to link to in the show notes if you're curious about the Fair Use Network project is a really good one for that. Profit doesn't strictly enter into it. The market question is more on substitutability. A lot of people have a kind of a common sense about this, that if they're not profiting on something, then it's fair use. That is a total red herring. It's really about whether you are robbing the rights holder of the ability in the way a judge is going to interpret that particular pattern of facts from their ability to profit by their work. So it's not whether you make money, it's whether they could have made money. And that's really another tough question with some very discouraging case law. Some plaintiffs have made claims retroactively. That is, they would have pursued an opportunity had they been able to predict it at the time that they fixed the work and accrued the copyright in the first place. So it can be a kind of a trap, where a small innovator tries something, then gets sued completely out of existence, regardless of whether the market opportunity actually existed when the work was originally copyrighted. This is actually another latent and somewhat ambiguous risk in the copyright term extension that I talked about earlier. When we get into another space where intellectual monopolies have sway, we have to be careful with them. In open source software and free software, we don't rely on fair use to define and enforce these public licenses. We use explicit legal language for a reason. There is no ambiguity about under what conditions you can use such software. It doesn't matter whether the license is copyleft, or it's academic, or it's proprietary. You always know where you stand because it's written out in the clearest language and we know how. Now, you may need lawyers, to be fair, to help interpret and enforce a license, but you never need a judge to work it out after a claim is made. In the presence of a claim, the license also works to defend your use. The license very often spends a great deal of time talking about revocation and consideration and obligation that flow both ways. Many of them are not just conditions on a copyright, but in a lot of cases, they also incorporate contract language so that you have, again, very explicit mechanisms for both parties to understand what their obligations are and what benefits they're going to derive from fulfilling those. Now, licenses aren't perfect for all works, to be fair. When do you attach a license? Nadez wrote with a story some time ago about a photographer that his wife worked with retroactively applying a license. I think that that's acceptable, but I don't think the use before the license could be excluded. So I think that the timing errors on the side of when somebody actually had access to work. It's difficult to say, though. Obviously, I'm not a lawyer, and I haven't actually read about any cases. As I said in the response I gave to Not Is in the listener feedback section a few weeks ago, I haven't read any stories about this tricky question of license attachment. When do those conditions come into effect? Has anybody actually tried to enforce them retroactively? Much of the language that the Creative Commons and public software licenses use about being non-revocable and non-exclusive doesn't really help clarify that question of timing of the attachment. The rights holder also, as I pointed out in my response to Not Is, can still fall back on their copyright to exclude use. Actually, Richard Stallman himself, one of the people who really drives free software, when people criticize the license that he helped create along with Evan Moglen and the other fine folks at the Free Software Foundation, when they criticize that, he says, fine, we take away the permissions for you to use on satisfying certain conditions, and what do we have left? Copyright. It's mine. I get to say how uses can be excluded. The only remedy you may have in the wake of that is maybe a breach of contract. If you're dealing, again, with a license that has contract language as well as in place of conditions on a copyright. I think this is why the Creative Commons licenses actually explicitly say non-exclusive. This leaves room open for other licenses with other conditions. They actually had a great campaign they ran a while ago, Rights Beyond, where they tried to make people really aware of the fact that you could do something with open content comparable to what folks do with relicensing or dual licensing of software. And I understand that there has been some debate about the validity and the merits and whether it's in the best interest of free software and open source to support these relicensing models. But regardless, the way that these licenses operate, it hinges on what it is that the rights holder really wants to do with it, both for good and for ill. Whether you like it or not, or you agree with it or not, we see this happen where software vendors will put forward a license with one set of conditions for free as in beer use, free as in cost, and a separate set of conditions for commercial use where money is actually exchanged, where they're paying a form of a tax, they're paying to waive the conditions, the reciprocity conditions in particular, say the GPL. Software, though, is a series of separate works. Each discrete version can be relicensed. There's an explicit public release where it becomes available for sharing, and that's the work that's being licensed. You can't really do that with a song or a photograph. There are some parallels when you, as the artist, remix a song. The new derivative work, or if you allow somebody else to make a derivative work, can be licensed separately, although sometimes that gets muddied with collective licensing and a chain of title in terms of who has rights into the work. But more often than not, for a creative work, it depends on triggering a transformation that makes new work, unlike software where we have that very natural means of pointing to something and saying version one is one work and version two is a new work that's completely distinct and separate. And as I talked about, again, in my response to Knott, is you have many examples where software projects have changed licenses over their lifetime, and they're able to make it very clear and explicit. Samba is one of the most recent cases that I can think of, that the 2.2 version of that software, if memory serves, is the GPL2, and the 2.3 and forward is GPL3. So there's a clear, clean break, and those are two very different works legally, very clearly and explicitly, so they can do that. If you want to share a work, though, think very strongly about a license. A Creative Commons license is a very good and clear signal of your intentions. Take your time, though, and think through the conditions. Once you attach the license, you can't revoke it. It's permanent. Generally, from a practical perspective, you can weaken an original license later on. When in doubt, you probably want to start, it's best to start with a strong license. Because it's going to be very hard to close the barn door, to attach a non-derivatives clause, to attach a non-commercial clause, if there's some copy of your work out there available under a more liberal license. I would recommend this process of attaching a license, of thinking about the terms under which that you are comfortable sharing, even if you're only going to distribute that work to a single person. You may not need a Creative Commons license for sharing with just one person, but some sort of formal license is a good idea. And certainly in the case of Nadez and the photographer and his wife, if they had had some sort of very simple written arrangement or some very clear understanding, a license, then that would have headed off the concerns that both parties had. Anything but a permanent license, though, is subject to change. Other than tenuous fair use defenses that I've already talked through, things devolving into the public domain, which increasingly is just not going to happen in anybody's lifetime that's currently alive right now, there aren't any limits on how a rights holder really can exclude use. A well-crafted, permanent license will prevent revocation, except when you violate the terms of a license. Somebody says non-commercial and you go and use their work in something that you're selling for a clear profit. non-commercials, probably not the best example since that's still a little bit muddied. Say share alike. That's one that's a little bit more clear cut. You remix something and then you don't share your changes forward. That's subject of revocation of license. You have violated the conditions under which somebody said it was okay to share the work. Without that clear and consistent expression of those conditions, though, then you are at the whims of the rights holder. Without a license, just because they say it's okay today doesn't mean they will necessarily think the same thing tomorrow. There's nothing binding them to that. They're the rights holder. They can do what they want with the work. Unless they grant a license and there's an actual agreement that you can rely upon, then you're putting yourself at risk. If you achieve any sort of success, you're almost inviting that risk, I think increasing it. Now, I will mention a site that I don't often mention, and it's one that's kind of languished for want of attention. Open Media Review is a site that I took over editorship some time ago, and unfortunately I haven't had much time to dedicate to it. But its reason for being is to highlight the best of open content. I think a better way of answering Alex's original question about embracing fair use. So this is content that's licensed clearly with a sharing-friendly set of permissions. And so PodSafe music, for instance, is now pretty easy to find. Books, though, less so. Movies, maybe even less. It is getting better with search engines, fit-for-use sites adopting Creative Commons like Flickr and the like. Google Books just adopted Creative Commons license support. Flickr's had it for some while. If you know of other examples you think are being underreported, so things that are below the size and notoriety of Google and Flickr and the like, then I encourage you to, this is why I brought this up, submit a link to Open Media Review, and I'll look into it there and share it with everybody else. That's why that site's there. Better yet, if you're interested in helping to draw direct attention and you want to become an actual ongoing contributor, you want to write articles, you want to post links of interest, review works, open content, and the like, let me know. I'm always looking for contributors. Unfortunately, as I said, my own resources for discovery are really hugely limited. Most of my reading time is actually taken up working on this podcast, but I am happy to follow up and share the recommendations of others. In your own writings online, always ask what the license is. So you're looking at some cool fan video, some completely original work, you're reading some electronic text, what have you. That should be, I think, one of the questions you're asking yourself. And then if it is open content, call attention to it. You don't have to submit it to me. You don't have to write a blog focused on open content to just have that be part of the what, whys, and hows of a story in your own blog posting or your own link sharing. Help educate the communities in which you participate for your own reasons why open media is a good idea. Last thing, considering specifically fan works, you can create those without needing fair use or a license. Copyright is only one restriction or barrier. For very recognizable characters, you do need to be aware that trademark may be a problem. Lucas, for one of the examples that we use for permissive use, actually has exerted some fairly debatable trademark claims on the term droid. There are limits and exceptions to trademark, but they're very, very narrow. There is a so-called fair use of trademark, as I understand it, but it's usually restricted to factually mentioning that it's a Kleenex rather than a tissue, something like that. Actually, that's another bad example because I'm confusing examples. But if you're referring to a Superman and you're referring to a Superman story in a comic book and you have to refer explicitly to the trademark character based on the facts of the story that you're relating, not a narrative story, but a news story, something like that. I talked about this some time ago. Again, I'll try to dig out the link that I found, the discussion around fair use for trademark. You have to wonder, though, for those creators who do use such means of enforcing trademark claims, is it really worth promoting their work? So if you're able to come in and you're not following a work so closely that it triggers somebody's desire to press a copyright claim, or you're not naming a trademark character or something like that, you're just working in the open spaces of homage or just fan remix or the like, if they in other instances have tried to press tenuous claims, then do you really want to support that? You have to bear in mind, like the Charles McGrath piece that I talked about in the last news show, where he talks about sequels and prequels being a very sincere form of homage. Do you really want to spend that effort on somebody who's not open and receptive to that kind of sharing. If you have a good character or story idea, why not make something new? We've seen some great stuff come out of that sort of circumstance. One of my favorite podcasting writers, the Arbiter Chronicles by Steve Wilson. That's what that is. It was originally intended to be part of the Star Trek franchise, written actually under license to them. This is, as I understand it, if Steve's listening, he should feel free to correct me if I'm mischaracterizing this. But as I understand that, when that deal fell through, he just turned it around and released that as an original work and an original universe. And those stories are fantastic. They stand up very well because it's good writing, it's good characterization. So if your stories are strong enough that you don't need that gloss of somebody else's universe, why not just put it out as an original work? As a creator, I would say that that's actually your strongest protection and your best case is if you're doing things that are wholly your own, then you won't be subject to the whims of a rights holder who may change their mind years from now or in some other way hold you beholden to them, even though your success is wholly your own. As always, if you have your own examples, counterexamples, anecdotes to share, questions, concerns, anything at all on this topic of, I think, how best we should be going about sharing creative works and embracing, if not the technicalities of fair use, very much the spirit of fair use, I'd be happy to hear them and to share them with everybody else. That's going to do it for this episode. As always, I want to thank you for listening, and if you enjoy the program, please go to the website at thecommandline.net, make a donation, purchase some swag, or at the very least, tell a friend. If you have a question, suggestion, or correction, you can send those to feedback@thecommandline.net, or you're welcome to post a comment up on the website. If you're away from your computer and the internet at the moment, you can call the listener comment line at area code 240-949-2638. The next show, which should go out in the feed Sunday night, will be a news program as usual, so until then, don't forget to hack your world. I would like to thank Libsyn and Waha to Be for media hosting and bandwidth. This show is produced from 100% recycled bits, and permissions to use those are granted under the Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike Version 3.0 United States License.